Good morning. I am Scott Tenona, a member here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Whether you're committed to a Christian theology of Easter, prefer the pagan roots praising fertility and rebirth, really don't take much trucking either. Celebrate Passover and identify as Jewish culturally, ethnically, or religiously. Whether you're transitioning between any of these, or maybe are just a little Easter curious, you are welcome here. Opening words this morning from retired UU minister Dick Gilbert. A tomb is no place to stay, be it a cave in the Judean hills or the dark cave of the spirit. A tomb is no place to stay when the fresh grass rolls away the stone of winter cold and valiant flowers burst their way to warmth and light. A tomb is no place to stay when each morning announces our reprieve and we know we are granted yet another day of living. A tomb is no place to stay when life laughs a welcome to hearts that have been away too long. If you'd take a moment and just say hello to your neighbor on this fine, cold, cloudy spring morning. Aren't they amazing? Thank you. Good morning again to all of you. If you're at all curious, if you're a visitor and are all curious about the fellowship here, please talk to me or a minister or anybody else afterwards and learn a little bit more about who we are and what we're up to. Draw your attention to the announcements and the order of service. There's a bunch of things going on in the coming up months. There's a potluck today, if you did not know. If you did not bring anything, you are still absolutely welcome. There's going to be an Easter egg hunt for the kids. Our annual meeting is coming up. There's lots of stuff in here. And the General Assembly for UU as the National UU is coming up. So these are all big, important things. So definitely pay attention to those, please. Our theme for the month is emergence. You see this beautiful Sylvia Beeman piece up here. I love it. Nice piece to reflect on for the month. We're going to change the order on the service a little bit and jump now into opening hymn. Opening hymn 1000, it's in the blue hymnal. If you would stand as you're able and join us in singing Morning Has Come, I will join with you. For our chalice lighting today, I'm going to light this chalice to symbolize the energy of our activism, the heat of our passion to love everyone, the warmth of our congenial, open, and welcoming community, the burning of our desire to live simply, eschew consumerism, and use our gifts to help those in need, the glow of our UU righteousness, the flame of our UU beacon, like a lighthouse in a dark ocean of corruption and ignorance, the brightness of our reason to see through the fog of other religions, the shining light of our vision for the rest of the world to come to us.
Ooh, boo!
Bo! Bo!
I can't believe what I just heard.
Bo!
You should be ashamed of yourself, Scott Denona. Vision for others to come to. I feel like I should say something in response to that. I'm speechless. In fact, what I want to say, I can't say. I don't believe in insults. I don't believe in talking down on people. So I'm not going to say what I think. I'm not going to call you a stuffed shirt. I'm not going to call you a pompous ass. I would never say that. Overeducated woggle bug. Pretentious professor know-it-all. I wouldn't say all those things.
Guys!
But I will offer an alternative. I will offer an alternative to your chalice lighting.
Okay.
I propose an alternative chalice lighting, a better one, an unsmug one, without elitism, without snobbery. Your chalice invocation advocates balkanization and segregation of our congregation. My chalice flame will represent the incineration and cremation of your invocation. It'll symbolize the restoration of a proper representation of our congregation, a celebration of our diversification and democratization. So there.
Hey. It's just a chalice, right? It's a symbol. What if we light it for the warmth that comes from laughing at ourselves, and for the wild spirit of mockery and April Fool's Day, which, if you all haven't realized, is today, and it coincides with Easter and Passover for the first time in more than 60 years. So may silliness resurrect us from pomposity and self-importance, and may humor liberate us from stodginess and stuffiness, and may we not always be solemn, grave, and grim.
I believe it is time for some special music. It's now time for the story for all ages. Those young and young at heart would come and join us up in the front. Sylvia Beeman has a story for you.
Easter, like Easter egg. Have you ever heard of the Navajos? Well, yeah. Do you know something about them? Oh, yeah. They do. They cornstalk is special to the Navajos. And are you Ariana? Oh, she said that. She's seen their dances, and that one of them they carry cornstalk. Yes, Virginia.
The Native Americans.
Yes, and they originally and still lived in the Southwest on the Colorado Plateau, and now that's an area called Four Corners because where their reservation is covers part of Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and what's the other one? Colorado. And they don't have much rain there, so the people have a lot of time to look at the sky and tell stories. And they tell this story that long, long ago, the people lived in three worlds underneath the earth, inside, deep inside the earth. And then they slowly rose from world to world. And then one day there was an opening in the surface of the earth, and first man and first woman climbed out, and all the other people came too. But it was dark there, and they only had firelight. So the people were kind of sad, and first woman said, okay, I'm going to send all you people out. I'm going to find a way to light the world. I want you to find a big, shiny, hard rock and bring it back here. So the people went out, and they came back with a great big piece of quartz. Do you know what quartz is?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that rock? This is made out of quartz, and it's clear, and it's really hard, and it's really shiny.
Ooh, well,
This one doesn't. But the people set to work, and because it was a big rectangular piece, there was just enough room to chip out two great big circles. And first woman and first man told them how to work, and they got their stone tools, and it was really hard going because quartz is really hard. And they chipped away until they had two great big circles, two big shiny discs. And first woman looked at the first one, and she said, this one we're going to call the sun. And she and first man put turquoise stones all around its edge, and first man put eagle feathers on the top and the bottom and the sides, so that it would know how to fly. And then first man sang a blessing over it, and that's the song of the sun, and so that it would know how to fly through the sky. And first woman said, okay, first man, carry the sun all the way to the east, over there by the mountains. And where the Navajos live, there are mountains east, west, north, north, and south. So he picked up the sun, and he started. Oh, this is north, sort of that way. Yeah, I almost did it backwards, didn't I? So he walked, and he walked, and he walked, and the sun was really heavy, and as he walked, it started to glow, and it started to get hotter and hotter, and it was really burning his hands, but he just kept going. And then what? He was getting closer and closer to the mountains, and the sun was so hot, he could just hardly... Sorry, I'm really nervous. I'm so sorry, you guys. He could hardly bear to hold it anymore because it was so very hot. And
why is the sun so hot?
because he had sung some magic into it. And now what do I do? Oh, I just remembered, you guys. Just a second.
What are you?
I'm so sorry. I'm just so nervous. I just can't remember. Oh. I hope so. I hope in my hands will remember what my brain is forgetting. Oh, this is the best one, too. Okay. Do this. Oh, this is right. Okay. Sometimes if you don't think too hard, did you notice that it's like sort of the thought comes back? So he got to the eastern mountains, and he reached up really high, and there, he put the sun up into the sky right between the two mountains. And because it had its special song, which is the song of the lark and the eagle feathers, the sun knew how to fly straight across the sky from east to west. And twice a year, it comes up exactly right between those mountains, spring, first day of spring, and first day of fall. And then he came back, and then First Woman said, well, now you have to put up the moon. And so they decorated the moon with pearly shells, and First Man put eagle feathers on the top and the sides and the bottom. And First Woman said, now carry the moon very carefully and put it in the east in the sky also. And so he was walking along, and the moon had its own song too, and he blessed it and put pollen on it so it would know how to fly. But the moon was so heavy, and he was so tired, he dropped it, and it bent the feathers. So the moon can never quite keep up with the sun, and every day it falls about an hour behind. And also, the light got a little bit broken. So instead of having the hot, blaring light and the heat of the sun, it has a cool light. But because it's a little bit slower than the sun, it sometimes ends up shining at night, a lot of the times. So it made a soft light for people at night, and that was pretty nice. So when he came back, the people still weren't happy. They knew when to get up and when to go to bed because there was night and day. But they still had so many questions like, ooh, what should I cook for dinner tonight? And where will the antelope be for when I go hunting? And I had a fight with my friend, and I don't know what to do. And so First Woman said to First Man, we have to make some rules for the people that everyone can see. Where can I write them? Oh, First Man said, why don't you write them in the dirt? Is that a good idea? Why not?
They'll blow away.
They'll blow away. Oh, well, First Man said, well, how about write them in the water? Is that a good idea?
No.
Well, why?
Because it won't.
Yes, and so the rules, nobody would know what the rules were. So First Woman was... It was night by then, and she was sitting there by the fire, and she was drinking a cup of tea. And then a firefly flew up into the sky. Oh, I know. I'll write the messages up in the sky. That's what she thought she'd do. And she looked at all the chips of the quartz that were lying on her blanket where they chipped out the sun and the moon. Perfect. I'll make some stars. And she picked up the first, a great big chip, and First Man sang a song over it so it would know what to do. And First Woman said, this is called the campfire star. It will always be up here in the north, and it will never move. And so if you're ever lonely and you don't know where you are, you can always find the campfire star and follow it back to the campfire of your home. And so that was the first star that went up. And are you wondering how First Man got it up there? Well, he had a crooked arrow. He had a crooked arrow. He put it in his bow. Pew! It made a zigzag path. Up into the sky, and he just climbed up it and stuck the star up there. And that's what happened. But meanwhile, Coyote was there. And do you know Coyote? Well, he's... Yeah, and he's very mischievous. He's always doing tricks, and he was whining. I want to put up a star. I want to put up a star, too. Why can't I have my own star? And First Woman was so annoyed with him that she got out her broom, and she tried to sweep him away. But he would not go away. And so finally she felt sorry for him because she did like Coyote. And she said, okay, I'll give you your star. And you have to be very careful because this is a very special star. This is going to be the second brightest star in the whole sky. And we call it Canopus. And you have to climb. First Man is going to shoot you another crooked arrow in the south. Pew! You have to climb up those stairs and put this in the sky. And here's your star. And here's a beautiful six-pointed star that she made for Coyote. And so it's very, very low in the star in the sky. We can't even see it in Manhattan. But if you go to Wichita, you can just barely see it in the summertime. And First Woman said, this is for you, Coyote, and you know when you can see this star, that's time for you to mate. Well, he put his star up in the sky, but do you think he was happy? Well, of course not. And First Woman was very slowly thinking about each star and figuring out where it should go, and she put one group of stars, Pleiades, and that told the people, when Pleiades disappears from the sky, that was time to plant. There was another one called Rabbit Tracks, and it looks kind of like this. When it's like this in the sky, it means it's in the fall. It means the hunters can hunt the fall and the winter. And then when it's like this in the sky, that means the animals are having their babies. That's in the spring and early summer. And then the hunters cannot fight, hunt. They cannot kill animals. Oh, did I say fight? I meant hunt. So Coyote was still being a big pill. And he just wanted to put up more stars. I want to help you. You're going so slow. Why can't I just help you? Because you're so impulsive and you don't understand. I'm making rules that are very important. But when she was not looking, he grabbed the edge of her blanket and he tossed it up in the air, and all the chips flew up in the sky. Pshhh, all the ones that she hadn't used to make rules yet. And so they were just scattered everywhere. But it was mostly the really tiny little pieces of powder and little chips. So they were very, very tiny stars, very far away. But that's why people still have questions about what to do. And so we still have to look for answers. But just like the Navajos, Unitarians believe that we can find truth anywhere. Like you could talk to a wise old person or a silly old person. You could talk to a wise child or a silly child and learn something, or a rock. Or you can look at the stars and get inspiration to answer your problems. Yes, Virginia?
Or a guinea pig.
Or a guinea pig. What could a guinea pig teach you? Maybe a flying
guinea pig.
Maybe a flying guinea pig. Why not? What could a guinea pig teach you?
It could teach you which vegetables have vitamin D in that, because that's usually the ones that feed them.
It can, that's interesting. And they can't make...
It can chop down trees at the bottom of their roots.
Well... There are some pretty amazing guinea pigs out there, I bet, who I've never met. So, well, thanks for listening to my story. Thank you.
Go with love, my heart is so with you. Go with joy, I'm also too. Burn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Go with love.
An excerpt from The Masks of God, Primitive Mythology by Joseph Campbell. The ambiguous, curiously fascinating figure of the trickster, appears to have been the chief mythological character of the Paleolithic world of story. A fool, a cruel, lecherous cheat, and epitome of the principle of disorder. He is nevertheless the culture bringer also, and he appeared under many guises: coyote, great hare, Brer Rabbit, raven, jay, Reynard the fox. In the carnival customs of Europe, this figure survives in the numerous clowns, buffoons, devils, pulcinellas, and imps who play the roles precisely of the clowns in the rites of the Indian pueblos and give the character of topsy-turvy day to the feast. They represent, from the point of view of the masters of decorum, the chaos principle. The principle of disorder, the force, careless of taboos and shattering bounds. Dr. Young's view is that the trickster is a collective shadow figure, an epitome of all the inferior traits of characters and individuals. Such a view, however, is presented from the ground of our later bounded style of thought. In the Paleolithic sphere from which this figure derives, he was the archetype of the hero, the giver of all great boons, the firebringer, and the teacher of mankind. It is hardly proper to call such a figure a god, or even think of him as supernatural. He is a super shaman, and we find his counterparts in myth and legend throughout the world, wherever shamanism has left its mark, in Oceania and Africa, as well as in Siberia and Europe. In Polynesia, Maui is the trickster. Brer Rabbit has taught us something of his African form, where he is also Anansi the spider. Among the Greeks, he was Hermes, Mercury, the shapeshifter and master of the way to the land of the dead, as well as Prometheus, the firebringer. In Germanic myth, he appeared as the mischief-maker Loki, whose very character was fire, and who, at the time of Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods, will be the leader of the hosts of hell.
It's now time for this morning's offering. The gifts that you give help us take care of this community and of the community at large. Thank you.
Wow. Our community is grounded in concern for one another, and because of that, we share with one another. One sharing that is special today is that Ruth Friedman has brought Passover matzah, since Passover is coinciding today with Easter. So there will be matzah at the Easter potluck. Thanks to Ruth. We have some, and in speaking of the potluck, Shirley says, since there's no hot water in the women's room, if you're going to work with the food, please wash your hands in the kitchen. Okay. So there are joys and concerns this morning. Sandy Nelson announces that her third daughter, whom many of you do not know, and her husband had a baby girl yesterday, Adeline. 7 pounds, 14 ounces. She also announces on the other side of life that her dad, who is in assisted living, is now strong enough to transfer himself from bed to walker. And so yesterday, he told the nursing staff he was going to go get some exercise. He called Uber and went home. Speaking of coming home, Michael Oldfather had a moment or two away from us in surgery this week, and he says that so many people have been kind and considerate since his surgery that he can't thank them all, but he is especially grateful for his daughter's gift of Time Doll to replace the one he lost.
Thymus.
Oh, Thymus Doll. And finally, with great joy and sadness, J.C. Hamm took a position in the Lawrence Public School System and will be moving in June. She and Laura will be leaving us. The joys and woes are woven fine. We hold in our hearts all these joys and concerns and those that remain unspoken.
Thank you for the O's. An excerpt from Trickster Makes the World by Lewis Hyde. Any discussion of this old mythology soon raises the question of where tricksters appear in the modern world. A first answer is that they appear where they always have, in Native American winter storytelling, in Chinese street theater, in the Hindu festival celebrating Krishna, the butter thief, in the West African divination ceremonies. African tricksters traveled west in the slave trade and can still be found in African-American storytelling, in the blues, in Haitian voodoo, and so on. I have been to a Yoruba diviner in Oakland, California, and seen the 17th palm nut set aside for the trickster Ushu. A second answer reverses the first. Outside such traditional contexts, there are no modern tricksters because trickster only comes to life in the complex terrain of polytheism. If the spiritual world is dominated by a single high god opposed by a single embodiment of evil, then the ancient trickster disappears. Here it is worth pausing to explain that the devil and the trickster are not the same thing, though they have regularly been confused. Those who confuse the two do so because they have failed to perceive trickster's great ambivalence. The devil is an agent of evil, but trickster is amoral, not immoral. He embodies and enacts the large portion of our experience where good and evil are hopelessly intertwined. He represents the paradoxical category of sacred amorality. One doesn't usually hear said of the Christian devil what the anthropologist Paul Radin says of the Native American trickster. Trickster is at one and the same creator and destroyer, giver and negator, he who dupes others and who's always duped himself. He knows neither good nor evil, yet he is responsible for both. He possesses no values, moral or social, yet through his actions, all values come into being. It might be argued that the passing of such a seemingly confused figure marks an advance in the spiritual consciousness of the race, a finer tuning of moral judgment, but the opposite could be argued as well, that the eraser of trickster figures or the unthinking confusion of them with the devil only serves to push the ambiguities of life into the background. We may well hope our actions carry no moral ambiguity, but pretending this is the case when it isn't does not lead to greater clarity about right and wrong. It is more likely leads to unconscious cruelty masked by inflated righteousness. Please rise if you're able for hymn number 344, A Promise Through the Ages Rings.
Spring about 30 years ago when I lived in West Virginia, I gathered with a bunch of other lesbians at one of our regular events celebrating the seasonal changes. A dear friend, Debbie, was part of the crowd, and I loved Debbie dearly. She had a great spiritual presence, but she was not always so strong on the practical pieces of life. I swear she was charmed, though. I have seen her wearing white linen pants and a white flowing blouse, reach into a dirty, grimy car engine, twist some parts around, and emerge with the engine now running without a gram of oil or dirt, spoiling her pristine white outfit. Anyway, on this particular lovely spring afternoon, several of us piled into a car crowded together, and she had plucked a wild edible plant of some sort. And as we settled in before the car was started, she explained to us the deep meaning behind the plant. Now, I can't remember the specifics, but each part had a meaning, the stem and the leaves and the flower yet to come. And she completed her insightful, poetic description of the meaning of this plant. And there was silence, a silence that seemed tinged with depth of understanding, a silence that went on and on until I reached into a bag of tortilla chips next to me, held aloft a chip, and said, "I wonder what the meaning of this corn chip is." I wasn't a minister yet. And though I have always held an appreciation for the spiritual, I also have what I believe is a healthy skepticism that has served me well. Debbie took my humor in stride. She christened me Heyoka after the sacred clowns of the Lakota people, figures not unlike those we have heard about earlier. Not wanting to misappropriate a title from another culture, I will simply present myself today as a bit of a clown, treating serious things without seriousness. At least that is my aim. Or is it? We take a great risk when we treat serious things lightly. That's why tricksters have such mixed reception. There are lines, and some people seem to go past them. As Lenny Bruce, the 20th century comic known for his vulgarity, said, "I know my humor is outrageous when it makes the Unitarians so mad they burn a question mark on my front lawn." Journalist and curmudgeon H.L. Mencken, well known for his well-placed jabs of humor, was accused of hating religious people. He insisted he was misunderstood. He did not hate them. He found them comical. And there's the risk. When we treat things or ideas lightly, we can appear dismissive or condescending to people who take them quite seriously. Often mockery of others' ideas is seen as mockery of people themselves, so it's touchy. If we treat our own beliefs and thoughts lightly, though, we can learn a lot. A UU colleague, Karen Gustafson, has described it as to disarm judgment for the purpose of opening up some other part of our being. We could simply call it to play. This morning I would like to play with some ideas to see what opens up, what emerges. Now, all that to say that I only treat Jesus lightly because he actually matters quite a bit to me. I deeply appreciate his teachings and find them helpful in the world. I stumble, though, on the question of how he might be God and on the whole resurrection story that underlies this holiday of Easter that we celebrate, sort of, today. Because I'm not the only UU who stumbles on those questions, but as the joke goes, when a UU is told, "I hear you deny the divinity of Christ," they assert, "That's not true. We don't deny the divinity of anyone." So, finally, on to the purported theme of this morning's reflection, Jesus and Elvis. As that great icon of false news, the New York Times, has said in a review by Neil Gentzlinger of the 2016 TV movie Elvis Lives, "Thinking people everywhere know that Elvis Presley is alive. We just disagree on the details, like where and how and what his hair looks like these days." Now, this particular document, so-called documentary from the huge Library of Things Elvis, described how Elvis, tormented by paranoia that someone was going to kill him, underwent an identity change and became some sort of drug enforcement agent or something. I haven't seen the movie myself, though Gentzlinger didn't much like the movie, saying, "Any theory that involves the non-death of the king should include space aliens or teleportation or Bigfoot or all three. If it's not called Elvis versus Mega Squid in the Bermuda Triangle, don't bother making it." Certainly, Elvis lives in our imagination, or at least in a bunch of people's imaginations. Fictionalized accounts continue to be cranked out. Elvis and Nixon, based on the real-life 1970 encounter of, yes, Elvis and Nixon. There's living proof of Elvis's continued life on YouTube. Oddly, the opening of one of those videos shows a crucified Jesus Christ. And there's a photo in there of the 80-some-year-old Elvis for all to see. You can't make this stuff up. Anyone in on the conspiracy theory track knows the details. His grave is marked with a misspelling of his middle name, Aaron. The cause of death was reported differently, and his father had the autopsy report sealed for 50 years. Sightings and photos show Elvis turning up in Vicksburg, Mississippi, Ottawa, Canada, Kalamazoo, Stockholm, and of course, Las Vegas. There's even a Facebook page, "Evidence Elvis Presley is Alive." There are two people, Jimmy Ellis and John Burroughs, who have been identified as actually being the living king. Elvis, like Jesus, was called the king, or more long-windedly, the king of rock and roll. Of course, he switched from genre to genre, crossing over from country to pop during the 1950s, holding on to those elements he had learned from Pentecostal gospel and Beale Street Black music in Memphis, and creating more hits than well, anyone. Despite others calling him the king, he was rumored to be humble rather than self-promoting. Bob Dylan said, "When I first heard Elvis's voice, I just knew that I wasn't going to work for anybody, and nobody was going to be my boss. Hearing him for the first time was like busting out of jail." Now, that's pretty close to describing him as a savior. Myth grew up around Elvis, and his home of Graceland became a pilgrimage site. His rags-to-riches story helped many people identify with him in deep and personal ways. Despite his fame, he gave autographs, posed for pictures with fans, and conducted himself excessively. And more than 40 years after his supposed death, we're swimming in media about Elvis. TV shows, The Elvis Files, The Elvis Conspiracy. There's a video game, Less Manly, in Search for the King. Even the movie, Bubba Hotep. Has anybody seen that movie? Yes. Okay, good. I'm glad somebody has. Where Elvis is living in a nursing home and battling a strange Egyptian monster. It's well worth seeing. And if you really want to confront the weird, there's Zombie Elvis. And I have to mention country singer Kenneth Chesney's masterpiece, Jesus and Elvis. So Elvis lives. And his labels of king and his non-death are not the only parallels with Jesus. Jesus said, love your neighbor. Elvis said, don't be cruel. Both are humble. They both affected the Western world profoundly. Some say they're both Capricorns, and both undoubtedly have strong cult followings. Cindy Godfrey even wrote a book about it, The Elvis Jesus Mystery, the shocking scriptural and scientific evidence that Elvis Presley could be the Messiah anticipated throughout history. Now, again, you cannot make this stuff up. Godfrey actually wrote that Elvis was the second Christ and faked his death so that his identity could not be discovered. Now, does anyone believe this stuff? Well, I remind you of the Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland, who sometimes believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Religions are full of impossible things to believe. The Passover story has a burning bush, that incredible series of plagues with frogs and locusts and all those guys, and the parting of the Red Sea. And Easter brings us a God-man who emerges out of his grave. My colleague, Karen Gustafson, who I quoted a moment ago, tells about dealing with her 5.5-year-old granddaughter. Being a UU and a very human grandmother, Karen was concerned about the influence the other grandmother was having over her granddaughter. This conservative Christian grandmother was taking the child to Bible school. Karen found herself relieved when her granddaughter was a little tired of that. She quotes her as saying, "At Bible school, we only learn about God and Jesus, God and Jesus. And besides, Grandma Mama doesn't believe in the tooth fairy." Because everyone knows the tooth fairy is real, right? So Gustafson was relieved her granddaughter believed in the tooth fairy and wasn't falling for all the other grandmother's God and Jesus stuff. We UUs can be awfully confused about the literal and metaphorical. So here's what Gustafson says about it. "I cannot help but wonder how I would respond if the pull of the Bible stories and Grandma Mama's denial had been stronger than the pull of the tooth fairy. Would I have been able to let those miracles stand without question? Raised from the dead, you say. Wow, that's amazing. But what's the difference, really?" Another colleague of mine, Karen Herring, writes, "My youthful skepticism about the old Bible stories left me without metaphors and language that I have since found to be invaluable for exploring the meaning of my life and its connection to others." Skepticism left this Karen without the metaphors and language she needed to explore the meaning of life. Because let's face it, objective, literal language can only take us so far in that meaning of life game. Yes, we need rationality. But we also need, says Herring, imagination. She quotes the poet W.S. Merwin, "A real metaphor and real image keeps bringing up new facets, new dimension, new distances." She adds, it also brings up new relationships. It opens perceptions. Every time we cross the bridges provided by good metaphors, we are able to look at the world from a different shore. And that, I would suggest, is one of the ways that jesters and fools and satirists aid us in finding meaning. Like Karen Herring, we have stepped away from many of the traditional stories. So while our Jewish neighbors celebrate the Exodus from Egypt, we doubt the stories and recast it in terms of freedom, but generally freedom for all people rather than a specific story about a specific people with all those messy and unbelievable details. And while our faith neighbors who identify as Christians celebrate today the resurrection of their Lord, we too agree that Easter is really important, but we're not entirely sure why. Maybe it has to do with the classic joke. The pastor on Easter asks the children what happens on Easter, and one of them starts, "The Easter bunny brings eggs." "Well, maybe," he says, "but how did Easter begin?" "Was it Jesus' birthday?" asks another confused child. "No, that's Christmas." "I know," says a little girl. "Jesus died for our sins on the cross." "That's right," says the pastor. "And then what happened?" "After 3 days, the rock rolls away from the tomb and miraculously Jesus comes out." "That's right," says the pastor. But the girl goes on, "And if Jesus sees his shadow, we have 6 more weeks of winter." Or maybe it's more like Somerset Maugham wrote in Of Human Bondage more than 100 years ago. A Unitarian very earnestly disbelieves in almost everything that anybody else believes, and he has a very lively sustaining faith, and he doesn't know quite what. We UUs tend to agree with theologians like Episcopal John Shelby Spong, who insists that the miracle of Jesus' resurrection is more than that his teachings survived, than that he himself experienced any kind of real resurrection. We tend to like Jesus as a teacher, even when he offers really difficult teachings, like turn the other cheek, and it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven. On the other hand, he's no more divine than the rest of us, so we don't have to take it all that seriously, right? Yet I wonder if we haven't taken Jesus too seriously. This struck me as I read a sermon by the late Kurt Vonnegut. Yes, the Kurt Vonnegut who wrote Slaughterhouse-Five and all those other satirical yet serious books. Yes, he wrote a sermon for an Episcopal church. He himself was not Episcopal, but identified as Unitarian more than anything else. Yet here he was, preaching at an Episcopal church on, of all days, Palm Sunday. I would say that they invited the jester into their house for a strong dose of irreverence on a holy day. Vonnegut took it seriously enough to play with it, though, and preached about the night before the triumphal entry into Jerusalem when a woman in the book of John, it says it was Mary, the sister of Lazarus and Martha, anoints his feet with oil, and Judas objects, saying the ointment could have been sold for the poor. And Jesus says, "The poor you have with you always, but you do not always have me." It's a troubling verse because Jesus had always been open and giving, not making excuses for why not to give things to poor people. Instead, Vonnegut, who in the sermon calls himself a Christ-worshipping agnostic, claims, here's the thing, it's a joke. He reframes it entirely, saying Jesus was saying something like, "Oh, Judas, don't worry about it. There will be plenty of poor people long after I'm gone." Can you think of Jesus maybe as a jokester? Let the one without sin cast the first stone. Whose picture's on that coin? Give Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Give God what belongs to God. Maybe treat the Jesus sightings of the first century a little more like the Elvis sightings of the 20th. Have I crossed a line? See, I think we can see Jesus in the line of rabbis. He was a rabbi, a teacher. Yet the rabbis were not the kind of teachers we're used to. They knew scripture backward and forward and exploited it to create imaginative flights of meaning. The Mishnah and Talmud that they wrote interweave different passages to create elaborations of stories, plays on words, unexpected juxtapositions of law and poetry, all of which became part of the tradition. The rabbinic toolkit includes puns, wordplay, and imaginative recreations of biblical stories. Even people talking to one another across time, people who couldn't have possibly lived at the same time. And when we take on that kind of play, new meanings emerge. And that's our theme this month, emergence. What emerges is what you could not have forced or constructed. What emerges is a new truth that you couldn't have imagined without that kind of loosening up and playing with serious ideas. What if Jesus, a rabbi, did the same thing in his teaching, played with the ideas, asked, what if? That's what many great religious leaders have done. Zhuangzi of the Taoist tradition is one of them, and I think he is totally hilarious. He's the one who says, more or less, I slept and dreamt I was a butterfly, flying about enjoying myself, and suddenly I was awake and was myself again, but I did not know whether I was myself who had been dreaming I was a butterfly or I was a butterfly dreaming I was Zhuangzi. So, I still remain unsure of what to do with this religious mystery of resurrection, but here's where it took me. When I thought of Jesus and Elvis, side by side, discovered alive by the people who adored and worshiped them. Have you ever lost someone you loved and adored? I have. And one day, I saw a man whose build so matched my late brother's, whose hairline was exactly the same, who had in his hand a Mountain Dew, my brother's trademark drink. He was gone in a flash, but it was as if I had seen my brother. Enough as if that it shook me. Maybe you've seen them. Those you've loved who've left the earth. Maybe you've heard them. Maybe you have felt as if they were still there with you when you nestled under the quilt that she pieced, or you smelled the scent of his aftershave, or you told the story they used to tell. It's as if they were with you. And maybe those disciples had that experience of someone emerging from death. And maybe that's too much, and Easter is better as a reminder of how the plants emerge from the earth, resurrecting again with the spring. Maybe that's better, safer, less disruptive to our thinking. And if you need a lesson this morning that nudges in that direction, I'll share this poem by Mary Oliver, called Field near Linden, Alabama, where she plays with the theme of resurrection of the earth in spring. And she plays with them by imagining birds. For hours, they float in the distance. Finally, they drift like black shingles from some old temple of the sun. So I know somewhere in the world the terrible cleansing has begun. Once across a field, I saw a dozen of them sit in a tree. I stopped the car and walked toward them until they were above me, huge and shifty in their leather wings, and what was below them in the grass was clearly dead. The story about Jesus in the cave is a good one, but when is it ever like that, as sharp as lightning, or even the way the green sea does everything quickly and with such grace? Clumsy and slow, the birds clattered down and huddled. Their beaks were soft as spoons, but they bent to their labor with a will until their bodies swelled. They could hardly climb back into the air and go flapping away. A year later, I crossed the field again, and in that hot place, the grass rises thick and clean. It shines like the sea. So the poet, Mary Oliver, doesn't make the spring resurrection sweet and simple, but it's real resurrection stuff. Not gentle with songbirds, but with buzzards. And messy, how life and death are intertwined and rely on each other. One does not come without the other. And that may be the message of Easter. Or maybe this is the message from Kenneth Chesney's song, Jesus and Elvis. So if you need a shot of whiskey and redemption, where the Delta meets the Sea of Galilee, get washed in the blood of the Mississippi mud. Come, all you non-believers, and you'll see. Our closing hymn is number 61, I think. Is that right? Yep. Lo, the earth awakes again. Before the closing words, if you remain in here, you may end up responsible for helping to hide eggs, because that is going to happen in here immediately after we finish. So, in closing, if today you celebrate the freedom of the Jews from the hands of their Egyptian masters, may you feel the joy and giddiness of freedom. If today you celebrate the triumph of Jesus over death, may you feel the heartbeat of life. If today you celebrate the chance to trick others, may you have a good laugh. Or may someone else have a good laugh on you. So may it be. Amen.